This podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people. We pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging, and acknowledge that colonisation and genocide are ongoing processes that continue to this day. Sovereignty was never ceded, and this always was, and always will be, Aboriginal land.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Auspol Snack Pod, the podcast where we serve you up bite-sized chunks of Australian news and politics with a side of crispy memes. We are also the official podcast of the Auspol Shitposting Facebook group. Come and join the group if you like Auspol or shitposting. Answer the questions or you won't get in. My name is Zachless Snack. I am a mod in the Auspol Shitposting Facebook group, and with me is my co-host.
Hey, I'm Noon. I'm going to deliver my introduction slightly less emphatically than Zach, but on Facebook, I'm Aino Funkenstein. I'm the admin and creator of Auspol Shitposting. Thanks for tuning in to our show again, and thanks for having me, Zach.
Oh, pleasure, always. Sorry for introducing the show so aggressively. I just felt like I was on a roll, and we haven't nailed the intro in like a few episodes.
Yeah, that's true.
I was just like, I feel like I'm gonna get it today.
Everything out there.
Yeah. And then I immediately got shut down for being excited about that.
No, you're doing great, Zach. you bring a nice energy to the room.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Noon.
You know who else brings a nice energy
to this
room? Is our patrons.
I love those patrons.
Yeah, they're really nice. They support the show. That we've got a couple of new ones, so I wanted to shout out Fred, Cal, Aiden, and Catherine. And a special extra shout out to Catherine, who's been doing a really good job of, like, making nice discussion posts and like engaging in the group in a really nice way, and
also invigorating the patron Discord, which
totally.
Is nice. We've got a special Discord server to get even more Auspol shit posts
totally.
Straight from the source. So yeah, if you like the show and you want to support us, hop over into Patreon. You can support us for $1 a month. You get an extra bonus episode plus access to the Discord. And thank you so much to the people who do support us. We really appreciate
Thanks.
It. We also had a little bit of a minor correction.
Yeah.
That we wanted to issue for something that we talked about last week.
Yeah, so thanks Seamus, our special correspondent from South Australia, for telling us that we were wrong about how voluntary administration works. So this is about George Colombaris, we mentioned last week, and over the last couple of weeks he's basically gone bankrupt, and we were like, there's no chance the employees are going to get paid, but apparently employees are often the top of the list of the people who get payouts from things, from companies going bankrupt.
So the creditors come in and take the money back.
Yeah, and the employees are like top of the list of the creditors. So that's
we made sarcastic
really good
comments about how it seemed unlikely. We could totally be wrong about that.
Yeah.
So our bad. If you listen to the show and we have said something wrong and you want to correct us, we love that.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah.
Please let us know.
Please do. Feedback is always usually positive.
Yep.
Cool. So, Noon, do you want to get into our entree this week? This is a really awful and sad story, and we're not going to spend a whole lot of time on it.
We're just going to talk briefly about the woman and three children who were murdered this week. If you want to skip this, we're going to put time in the show notes that you can just skip ahead a couple of minutes to our next story. But this has just been everywhere in the news. It's extremely horrifying and sad story. And obviously the murder was despicable. And then the way that the police and the media have been responding to it has for the most part been pretty bad. There was a police chief who...
He was the lead investigator.
Chief. Yeah, yeah.
Was the lead investigator on the case. And he said that they were keeping, quote, an open mind
about what might have driven this guy to commit this crime.
Yeah.
And
he also went on to say that he thought that there were people in the community who might be, like, as he described it, taking a side on this,
right,
and as in siding with the woman and her three children who were murdered,
yes,
or siding with the person who did it, which is obviously very upsetting statement to make.
Yeah.
He's offered his resignation in the wake of the kind of backlash to this.
Well, he stood down from the investigation.
And I
heard an interview with a woman who's the CEO of a domestic violence organization in the Gold Coast, who said that she worked alongside this cop for many years and that he's basically always been really good about this stuff, and that she was extremely surprised that this kind of, like, nonsense came from this person of all the cops who might have bad opinions that she was surprised that this guy said it. So that actually made me feel slightly less resentful of him, that this woman, who I'm sure wasn't just like trying to protect the police or whatever, had a positive feeling about him. But anyway, obviously that was pretty shitty. And then in the media, we've seen a whole lot of stuff about like just the same nonsense that we get every time a man murders a woman or his children, that like, oh, he was a loving family man, or like,
He was driven too far by not having access to his children.
Totally.
Yeah, no, and like, really lots of passive, really passive headlines.
And that, like, includes him as one of the people victims. Whereas he murdered them, prevented, like, physically intimidated people who tried to help them, and then stabbed himself to death. Like, he was not part of the victims here.
No, and look, there was a little bit of pushback from some media figures talking about, there are certain limitations on the way that media can report on this stuff when it's still, technically an allegation.
Yep.
And not like a legal fact, I suppose. But that is that by no means accounts for the really backwards and horrible way that this is being reported on. And it's just disappointing that this is where the conversation goes every time one of these stories is in the news. So obviously we have a really long way to go on this issue, and we've discussed it in a bit more detail previously.
Yeah.
But the media response and the kind of discourse is one side of it. When you were speaking earlier about this interview with this social worker that you were talking about just before that you heard on ABC, you were talking about like a response system that's been implemented in Queensland that she feels has been particularly effective. And so I wanted to just talk about a slightly more practical response, not just one that deals with the surrounding conversation, which is important, obviously, and we need to be tackled, because this is a cultural issue in terms of the way that we view men's violence against women and family obliterators in general. But it's also, I think, helpful to try and direct the conversation a little bit towards more what policy or practical solutions might be.
Yeah, and look, there's been a whole lot of studies and inquiries and stuff into this, and we do know what needs to happen. At least we know some of the stuff that might make a big difference. And the media reporting and so on, all of that sort of the way that we use language around it does contribute directly. But there are, like, short-term policy adjustments that we could make that will make this kind of thing much less likely. Apparently on the Gold Coast, domestic violence services are really closely integrated with a whole lot of other services. So the reason that this woman had been working and knew this officer so well was that the police family violence unit is integrated with her peak body for domestic violence survivors or victims, and also with hospitals and also with schools and general practitioners and Centrelink, all this other stuff. So if a woman turns up to hospital with certain injuries, then the hospital notifies the domestic violence services, who then can get in touch with her or try and, you know, figure out what's going on. And conversely, if, you know, a man who's on one of these lists gets arrested for some other crime, then potentially that will also lead to these social services connecting with the women and children.
This is Queensland specific.
So that was in the Gold Coast. Yeah, I don't think it's even across the whole of Queensland.
Right, okay.
But she said that that's basically, those integrated responses are sort of the best practice that we have. And apparently also in the Gold Coast, there are something like 50 men on a high concern watch list, who there are sort of SWAT teams basically sort of on alert, ready to go if there's any indication that these men might be about to commit some violent act. Yeah. And she also talked a bit about like counseling for men. And I think there's a lot of debate about what role that should play, and whether or not it sort of excuses or let people off the hook or that sort of thing if they get counseling rather than like jail time or whatever. But she seemed to think that,
all right, after the fact.
Well, you know, I think that there are different things for different people. And, you know, as all of the research shows that these, like, extreme acts of violence, like we've just seen this multiple murders, almost always come after a period of smaller violences, things like...
Yes. And we do know that in this specific case that there was a long history of domestic violence being perpetrated by the father and husband in this.
Yeah. So stuff like smashing plates or slamming doors or yelling or hitting people that then becomes more extreme, that stuff. But like men who become aware that their behavior is on that track but then go to counseling can often make differences and so on. And this woman actually said that the people who assess whether or not the programs are being effective are the family members of the men who were there.
Mm.
So it's not like the men self-report like, oh, yeah, I've been great or whatever. But yeah, I just sort of wanted to draw an analogy between this integrated response and something that we talked about quite a long time ago now about how First Nations people can have integrated relationships with the police department. So when First Nations women get arrested or taken in by police, the first thing that should happen is a phone call to the like Aboriginal Legal Service or the peak body of the actual nation that that person's a part of, and that dramatically reduces the likelihood of those people dying in police custody. And these sorts of integrated responses between emergency services and social services, I think, are really valuable and something that we need to roll out across the country for all sorts of different groups, but in this context specifically, yeah,
with sure.
children, family violence.
Thanks for giving us an overview on that. I don't mean obviously to downplay the role of changing cultural attitudes around this stuff. And you know, let's be explicit about this. This is a men's problem. Mm. This is something that men have to solve. It's on us to do that. So just want to make our position very clear on that.
Yep.
And one thing that we didn't mention at the top of the story was the names of the family involved. I do just want to say their names, not the name of the man that was involved, but Hannah Clark and her children, Aaliyah, Liana, and Trey. It's very easy, I suppose, for the... There's a lot of the sensationalist reporting around this that sort of overemphasizes, you know, giving kind of trying to develop some kind of psychological or emotional context for these acts, which is obviously much less helpful than looking at what, you know, societally speaking is the context for these kinds of actions.
Mm.
But I do think at the same time, it's important to personalize these events and not just let them get folded into these horrible statistics about violence, domestic violence against women and children. So I think we'll probably move on from that now. Tonal whiplash, as is, it's really a feature of the show. But now it's time for
Positivity Corner.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that's a smaller whiplash than we might get if we dived into Shitpost of the Week. You know, I think, it's a gentle whiplash.
Hopefully the whiplash isn't too bad. This is a new segment that we introduced last week, and where we just wanted to make sure that every week we were bringing something, a little something that made us feel a bit better or okay about Australian politics.
Yep.
And for me this week, something that gave me a little bit of hope was the Juice Media podcast with Simon Holmes, A Court. So Juice Media are the people who make the Honest Government ads. If you are in any way an Auspol shit poster, then I'm sure that you are very familiar with them.
I think they also used to do Juice Rat News.
They did,
which I fucking loved, especially the Israel-Palestine.
It's really good.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I won't quote any of it because nearly all of it is deeply problematic.
Here at the peace process.
Ready to commit war crimes. I mean
raw rhymes. Yeah, it's deeply proper. But also...
True.
Informative. Feet normal Finkelstein as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is anyway.
He's a real guy.
He is a real guy.
Just played himself.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, okay, right. No, that's what I'm saying. Was it was a proper, impressive like, that Jewish they... name.
No. Right. It's impressive. That... Noon is Jewish. Just for context. No, it was impressive that they got. He was a good get for Juice Rap News. Anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
So the Juice Media puts out a podcast that accompanies all of their videos, which I only discovered this week. Jordana from the Juice was just talking to Simon Holmes, A Court, who is a senior advisor to the Climate and Energy College at Melbourne Uni and is on the board of the Smart Energy Council. And I think he's got bureaucratic experience.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure about that, but he is like in line to become a baron. or an earl or something.
His dad was Australia's first billionaire. Yeah. So look, he also unforgivably is the person who created the teardrop Twitter.
Yeah.
He was the first person to do that and everyone else followed him. So look, I don't particularly love this dude on a personal one-to-one level, but he is one of the most vocal people on Australian political Twitter talking about climate change and specifically energy policy. He's like an energy transition expert, basically. So the Juice podcast is just sitting down with him and in really quite simple and direct terms, just kind of laying out exactly where Australia is in terms of energy transition towards renewables and decarbonizing. And Simon Holmes Acourt is a very experienced communicator on this issue. And he laid out a few things that I guess what I was trying to communicate to you before we started the podcast and why this is a positive thing, even though like we still have a really long way to go and energy policy is only one part of the picture, climate change can feel like this massive, amorphous, intractable problem that is so kind of complicated and we are so far behind that it's almost pointless trying to do anything about it. I, you know, think most people can probably relate to that feeling of helplessness or despair to a certain extent. And something we tried to address in our Climate Cookies episode towards the end of last year.
Which we got a lot of great feedback about, by the way. So if you haven't listened to our back catalogue, that's probably a good one to jump into.
Yeah, for sure. Probably one of the more evergreen episodes. But so listening to this 45-minute just breakdown of like where we're at the moment, what are the kind of roadblocks and how can we kind of achieve how can we achieve decarbonization in the energy sector, I found really helpful and I came out the end of it feeling positive. One of the things that he mentioned that made me feel good was that we are already at 22% renewable energy, nationally speaking, and we're likely to get to 33% within the next 2 to 3 years, which will represent more progress in that 2 to 3 years than we've made in the past 13 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, things are getting there exponentially faster in this particular respect.
I was just going to say that this has been something that renewable energy / anti-coal people have known about for a while, a snowball effect, and the whole issue of, like, stranded assets of, like, once enough people start moving away from fossil fuels, the people who are still there will suddenly be left holding really, like, unprofitable investments. And it's going to get faster and faster. And once we hit a tipping point, those remaining ones are going to start being, like, unviable, basically.
And absolutely. We're definitely already getting
there. We're getting close to that point.
Like, I mean, definitely building new coal-fired power stations is a massive, like, economic black hole.
Yeah. Though we are just about to open our largest ever fossil fuel project in Australia, which is a gas pipeline / distribution thing up in the northern Western Australia.
Positivity Corner.
Oh, sorry.
Positivity
Corner. No, it's fine. We're all good. please go on.
No, not that there isn't a long way to go, but it breaking down and understanding the problem makes me personally feel a lot less helpless about
it.
And just before we get off this, one of the other positive things that Simon Holmes Acourt mentions is that we as a country are particularly well placed to be climate leaders, and not just in a kind of rhetorical sense. And not just in the sense that we are literally per capita the worst emitters and therefore can make, like, per capita the biggest difference if we decarbonize, but also that we have the ability, we have the natural resources to export renewable energy to the rest of the world in the form of hydrogen.
Yeah.
And that's already kind of in train, and there are several, like, technological innovations that have happened in Australia that haven't been taken up here because there's no
government
support for it. But people in Europe, for example, taking up technologies to massively decarbonize their production of cement, for example, is something that, like, that was a new technology that was developed in Australia. So, look, progress is happening. If you break it down, you know, on a policy level, that there are several really practical, good steps that we can take. And obviously, we've got heaps and heaps of work to do. But
there was sort of another aspect of this that I wanted to mention about the Liberals' technology roadmap.
Oh, yep, totally.
Yeah. That I don't want to give too many cookies to the Liberal Party for this thing, which is, like, reasonably weak, but this is, like, a policy direction that the Liberal Party is trying to put out there, which is a energy technology roadmap. And the idea of it is basically it's a way for the Liberal Party to have some climate policy without having too much of a climate policy, right? Because they don't want to get the Nats offside and all of the like coal lovers in their party. So this roadmap...
Why would a party that represents regional Australia want to decarbonize? That's so stupid.
Yep. It's ridiculous. the roadmap seems like it's going to be reasonably sensible in terms of decarbonizing. It just won't have a number that says zero carbon by 2050.
Targets are very scary for the Liberal
Party.
Yeah,
targets of women, targets for climate change, they hate it.
Yeah. For people who are so obsessed with surplus that really don't like numbers.
No, that's right, yeah. But... Look, for the sake of the positivity corner, I think this is a sign that Scott Morrison and the leadership of the Liberal Party are interested in doing at least slightly more about climate change than they have up until this point. And they're trying to find ways to make that palatable to the far right / reactionary rump of their party. And I think that's a good thing.
It is. And look, it's very minor, and we are not congratulating the Liberals on doing not even the bare minimum for what they should be doing. But it is important to remember that globally speaking, the Liberal Party is one of the worst political parties
literally
when it comes to climate change.
World.
They deliberately scuttled the 97 Kyoto Agreement. Like, it was John Howard's government that did that. So on a global scale, like, we have done... And the Liberal Party specifically have worked tirelessly against taking climate action.
First party in the world to get rid of a carbon tax.
Yep.
Which is...
Great legacy.
Yep.
Awesome legacy. So, but even these most kind of minuscule movings of the needle towards action, like, represent, relatively speaking,
totally.
A pretty big move in this country. So, look, let's take the good from that.
Yep. Positivity corner.
Yeah. And before we put a final pin in the positivity corner,
yes.
I'm going to make it a bit more negative, or at least a little bit more nuanced. Because we got a little bit of an update to the thing that we talked about last week.
In our positivity corner.
Which is Paul Parker, the rural firefighter who went viral for telling Scott Morrison to get fucked. And then it came out that he is a Pauline Hanson supporter, and this kicked off a huge discourse.
Well,
and,
you say it came out. Chris Yuleman did a tweet where he was like, oh, I wonder what the left will say when they find out the truth about their hero who told Scott Morrison to get effed actually likes Pauline Hanson. I reckon they're going to cancel the shit out of him. And some people did, right? Like Twitter... some people were like, oh, milkshake duck, whatever.
Yeah.
And then Chris Yuleman tweeted out, like, a couple hours later, like, you know, us progressives really need to not cancel people so much. And
eat shit, Chris.
Yeah.
For all
tell
time.
Chris Yuleman to get fucked from Ozpol's network.
Good one, Noon.
Yeah. So I think... Sorry. Yeah.
No. Well, look, I guess I just... I don't particularly want to... I don't think that we have time to get into the weeds on this conversation. There is so much caught up in this. And it is an interesting conversation to have. You know, does the fact that he supports Pauline Hanson negate the fact that we are on the same side when it comes to telling Scott Morrison to get fucked and, being very upset with the government's inadequate response to the bushfire crisis? Did we personally, or... Let's be honest, me personally, when I talked about him representing Australian larrikinism, give him too much credit? And is that the level of would somebody who wasn't a white man from regional Australia have ever gotten the same amount of attention or slack for yelling at the Prime Minister because he fits that perfect picture of larrikinism? These questions are kind of pretty complicated, and a lot of the discourse, I honestly think that most of the discourse I've seen about it on Twitter hasn't been people canceling him.
Yeah.
More people being like, well, look, we can't automatically alienate everybody who has views that don't jibe with our own. But obviously that's complicated because if you support Pauline Hanson, you are obviously supporting absolutely disgusting, abominable, horrible, racist politics and rhetoric, and you can't overlook that either. So I mean, this points towards a very complicated problem that we have on the left, which is how to build solidarity across class lines, across race lines, and across the urban-rural divide.
Divides of various sorts,
absolutely. Without betraying our values or alienating a massive chunk of the population. And that's really hard, and it's an ongoing process. And I guess that this story is a great... I don't know if I'm using this word correctly, but no, I'm not. So I'm not even going to say it. I think that this is a great example of how complicated this is and how media narratives can just massively oversimplify these conversations.
Definitely.
And also misrepresent the conversations. Like, if you're talking about what Chris Ullman says the left is saying, that is not what my personal experience of what the conversation
is. No, absolutely not. And, well, I resented Chris Ullman here because, like, he sits somewhere between the Liberal Party and Pauline Hanson on most issues, and he clearly was stirring this shit specifically to make lefties look like idiots and or hypocrites and or aggressive, like, reactionaries against this, like, person they thought were a hero or whatever. Like, he's just trying to make people look like idiots.
And
for whatever their view is on this. And
disingenuously
about it.
Massively disingenuous. And also playing into a corporate mainstream media that only leaves room for these extremely simplified conversations and that don't have the space for the nuance that this story embodies.
Yep.
And neither do we, so we're going to move on.
Cool.
So did you want to do the... we're going to do a First Nations story now?
Yep.
Yeah, okay, cool. So this is... not this is kind of more of a story from last week than this week, but there's been an ongoing high court case about whether or not the Home Affairs Office and Australia in general can deport Aboriginal people.
Because, of course, that's what we're spending our time debating in the public discourse, yeah.
Yeah. It's a bad... system.
Wow, it's a contentious view there, Zach.
Yeah, bad system, bad country. Countries in scare quotes. So I guess the good news is that the High Court has ruled 4-3 in the case of one of the two people in question here that no, you can't deport this guy, and he's been released from immigration detention. That guy's name is Brendan Toms. So he was born in New Zealand, but he is an indigenous person. He just wasn't born here, and so he doesn't have citizenship. And that's kind of the legal question that this case hinges on. So basically, the High Court decided that Aboriginal people cannot be considered quote-unquote aliens for the purpose of the Constitution, and therefore you can't deport them.
Right.
So it's all very kind of technical, specific, legal stuff. The second plaintiff, Daniel Love, who was born in Papua New Guinea and considers himself an Aboriginal person, a member of the Gamilaroi tribe, and the High Court basically couldn't decide whether or not to consider him an Aboriginal person.
Right, because there are three tests for whether or not you're considered Aboriginal, which is self-identity,
biological descent,
and integration or acceptance by the tribe that you're claiming.
Exactly. Recognition of indigeneity by a traditional group. So this was stuff that was established under the Mabo native title cases.
Right.
The decision has kind of come down to this question of whether or not... Well, it's a basic question of sovereignty, really. Like, if you are not an Australian citizen, we have the right to deport you, says the colonial government. And the argument against that has been, well, no, Aboriginality actually precedes and is more important.
Yeah.
As a more important indicator of whether or not someone belongs to this land than whether or not they are an Australian citizen, which is obviously a fucking no-brainer for anybody who's engaged with this stuff.
Yeah.
But it's some real kind of mask-off shit, I think, from the High Court, like from the conservative judges when you read minority judgments.
Yep.
And what they said about this.
Sorry, for people who don't know, minority judgment is like the court split 4 in favor and 3 against. And so the 4 in favor wins, that's the majority judgment. And then the minority judgment is the others being like, yeah, well, if we won, this is what we would have said.
Exactly.
And it's often used as like arguments for then future discussions about this issue.
And which is exactly what has happened in the case of Christian Porter, the Attorney General, who is the person kind of spearheading this, aside from Peter Dutton, of course. And he's basically said that, yeah, we're still going to do our best to deport these people. We're just going to try and find another way to do it.
Yep.
So I'm not sure if I made it clear at the top, but the issue is that these two people have committed crimes and served jail times, and now the government is trying to deport them on the basis that they are criminal and not citizens. So that's kind of the specific context for the case. But so Christian Porter is now using these minority judgments from these conservative judges to argue, or to argue that, no, like, we have the right to deport anyone who isn't an Australian citizen, even if they're Indigenous. So one of the conservative judges suggested Aboriginality was not relevant at all to Australian citizenship. Indigenous Australians became British subjects because Britain exercised sovereignty over the entire territory of Australia, and later generations became subjects in the same way as non-Indigenous Australians. So that's what I mean when I say it's mask-off shit. Like, yeah, they're very clearly saying,
we don't give a fuck about what came before us. We're in control, and what we say is more important than anything else.
We are the only legitimate legal entity on this continent.
Yeah.
And one of the other really fucked things that one of the conservative judges recommended was that they said that if the parliament was looking for another way to deport these people, that instead of trying to do it through the High Court, they could legislate. He suggested one of the ways to do that could be through racially targeted legislation enacted under Section 51 of the Constitution, which is, and there's a subsection, I think it's in the 26, maybe, which is called the race power. And this is really interesting or a historical constitutional section, in my opinion. This is one of the two sections of the Constitution that was subject to the 1967 referendum, which is often cited as a time when Indigenous people were given the right to vote, which is not correct.
Yep.
It's often cited as a time when...
It actually, not even not correct, it had nothing to do with that whatsoever and didn't affect it in the slightest.
No,
yeah.
Exactly. But so this particular section of the Constitution was originally written in such a way to try to actively stop the government discriminating legally against Indigenous people. So basically it says that... the government of Australia has the right to make laws specific to any race of people except Aboriginal Australians. Well, Indigenous people, they refer to them as Aboriginal Australians.
And you said this was originally basically to fuck with Chinese workers, right? Like
that was the reason that the law was... Yeah, that they
that was written into the Constitution in the first place. Race-based laws, but then not including First Nations people was seen as like... somehow respecting their sovereignty to some extent.
Basically, yeah, the logic being like, oh, if we put this law in, like, the main thing that the government is going to do with it is discriminate against Indigenous
people.
Which
is probably true.
right. But so the 67 referendum was actually about taking out that caveat in the race powers, saying that, no, the government should be allowed to make laws specific to Indigenous people. The idea being we should be able to make specifically positive laws regarding Indigenous people.
Yep.
which, you know, has happened, but also...
the opposite.
A later High Court ruling, I think from the 80s, was like, yeah, you can also legally use this to make life harder for Indigenous people specifically, if you want to. So that's cool and legal. And that's what this conservative judge is suggesting the Australian government now do, that we use the piece of legislation that was specifically or... We attempted to make less racist with the 1967 referendum, and he's like, just use it to make their life worse. It's
fine. Just be you're racist with this anti-racist.
Yeah, you're legally thing. Allowed to do this.
Yeah.
So look, this is kind of it all gets very kind of legally specific, and it comes down to the fundamental question of whether or not. The Australian state has any legal legitimacy on this continent. And obviously the position of this podcast is fuck no, not at all. Australia doesn't exist. And this is all garbage.
It's straight up illegitimate.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. Just to close out this section, I just wanted to read this quote from a Guardian article, and they interviewed a Wumba Wumba lawyer named Eddie Sinnott, who's the manager of the Indigenous Law Centre at the University of New South Wales. And, you know, he basically said that the judgment was just a very narrow, this particular judgment is a very narrow application of the alien's power. So it's a very specific sort of legal jargony thing, applies to a very small number of people. But it's specifically not a recognition of Aboriginal sovereignty.
Yeah.
He said, "More than anything for me, today just confirmed that the High Court is never really going to be an environment where we're ever going to be able to settle those original questions about sovereignty and the founding of nations," he said. "It's going to have to be a political decision outside of court." So, you know, obviously implicit in this entire legal question is the idea that the Australian legal system has the right to decide whether or not someone is Indigenous in the first place, which is completely fucked. But obviously the apparatus of the white supremacist settler colonial state is never going to be able to effectively promote the interests of sovereignty.
Or support it, yeah.
Exactly. Mm. So it's this kind of legal dead end, I guess, for this, you know, in if you're trying to achieve something longer term and greater when it comes to Indigenous sovereignty. But so, look, that's an interesting case. There's lots of ins and outs. It's not over yet, and the government isn't done trying to deport these two specific people. So, we'll keep tabs on that as it comes up. I am in no way a legally minded person, so it's probable that I got a whole bunch of stuff wrong. And I wonder specifically our Adelaide correspondent, who is a law person, might have something to correct, some things to correct me on.
Yeah.
So please write in, or alternatively, you could send in a potluck.
Potluck, where you bring the snacks. Yeah, and so this week we have an anonymous potluck from a listener who has some hot takes about the wage theft situation in HOSPO. So anyway, over to our anonymous listener.
Hello, Noon and Zach. I have a rant for you that has been building deep in my body over months and years, as I see big business after business fucking over their employees through incessant corporate greed. This week, that rant has deepened into a full-bodied roar with the news that Coles has underpaid its supermarket managers by $20 million over 6 years. $20 million. $20 million stolen from the pockets of workers. We've seen scandal after scandal in the last few years, but most big business seems able to ride out the storm. To be honest, it does affect me when I see the smaller ones going bust. Owners put their heart and soul into starting up their businesses, but it's really hard for most people to live off the minimum wage. People who work full-time shouldn't be living in poverty. No one should. So if business can't afford to pay a living wage, it shouldn't be in business. And if the accountants at Coles can't figure out how to pay managers overtime, it's a wonder that they managed to form part of a massive duopoly that's fucking over farmers and small business as well as its own workers. The award system legislation is kind of hard, but complexity doesn't stop big business from being able to interpret the intricacies of tax law so that they can funnel the profits earned off the backs of workers into offshore accounts and their own property portfolios. And can you imagine if that were my legal defense? Oh, sorry, Your Honor. I didn't mean to steal his yacht. It's just the legislation's too complex for me to understand. To be fair to Coles management, they said they didn't realise that they'd deprived workers of their wages and it was all a mistake. So for anyone who lives by the philosophy of be gay, do crime, Ozpol Snack Pod heavily encourages you to forget to pay for your groceries when you hit the Coles checkout this weekend. Solidarity forever. Fuck Coles and Woolies. Rant over.
Thanks. We don't, generally speaking, encourage our potluck submission to include statements on behalf of the podcast, but in this case, it is correct. We do endorse being gay and doing crime. Feel free to shoplift from Coles, but not from small businesses.
Yeah, Coles and Woolies absorb the costs. Like, they they absorb the costs of losses from theft into the prices of their items.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry about that. I think our anonymous listener also makes a good point when it's like the some of the biggest businesses in the country who, you know, have millions of dollars in turnover can't pay their workers. Weird how that works out. It's almost like the system is designed specifically or built on exploitation of workers, but that can't be right.
No, that seems ridiculous. It seems like probably everyone receives the full value of their labor power and wages. Yeah.
Mathematically speaking, that makes sense to me.
Yep.
And I would like to buy your leaflet.
Where does profit come from? Anyway, let's move on to our next segment.
Just before we
get back into the communism, but yeah.
Yes, there's more communism to come. Thank you, anonymous listener, for that submission. If you would like to submit a rant to the show, we do heartily encourage you to record less than 1 minute
less
of audio.
Less than 1 minute.
Less than as 1 minute of audio.
More than 2 or 3 minutes. But thank you, nonetheless, ranters. But
obviously,
like,
we're fucking a soft touch for that shit because we just played 2 3-minute ones 2 weeks in a row. And they were good rants, so we played them. But if you want to submit, please record a little voice memo, 1 minute or less, and email us at ozpolsnackpot@gmail.com. And if we vaguely agree with it, we'll play it on the show. Even if we disagree, we'll probably play it. Cool. So, yes, please submit. Thank you, anonymous listener. Now it's time for...
Shitpost of the Week. So, it's been a little while since we've had a shit post. Normally we do, you know, shit posts, but this time there's been a really shit post by the Liberal Party on Twitter, at Liberal Oz. And this is, for some reason, a video tweeted with the caption, "Anthony Albanese is just Bill Shorten 2.0 when it comes to not being able to explain the cost of his policies." And Zach, do you want to run us through the visuals of this?
Yeah, so this is like a 15-second video, and the visuals is these two photos of Anthony Albanese and Bill Shorten's faces kind of shittily morphing into one another, morphing back and forth for like 15 seconds. And there's text at the top of the video that says, "Uncosted climate policy, Bill Shorten 2.0. But the video, there's only like 3 seconds of content, and it just played over and over
again. Yeah, yeah.
Like the faces keep morphing. The text
disappears
and then
comes back.
Pops up again. My favorite thing about this video, and why I really wanted to give it shitpost of the week, is it's got this amazing like slapping sound effect that they use when the text comes in. Just let me hear that.
And that's Bill Shorten. And now it's Albo again. And now it's Bill Shorten. The text is coming. And it's Albo again.
Authorized, I Hearst, Liberal Party candidate.
It's just really incredibly bad.
It just really tickles me, the slapping sound effect of the same text coming onto screen again and again and again.
You
amazing
know when you watch
stuff.
A GIF on Facebook and then it starts again? This is like that, except it didn't start again. It's just played.
It keeps going.
Yeah.
So amazing work from the Liberals' social media team there.
Yep.
I mean, they do have this like fire hose strategy, which is basically like just churn out the absolute most amount of content you could possibly do. They were using this one particular right-wing social media firm who I can't remember
the name of off the top of my head. A little while ago, there were two guys who made like millions of dollars just doing like game of Bill Shorten or whatever.
The absolute shittest possible, like deliberately making these dank ass bullshit memes. But the idea is you just absolutely flood everybody's social media with this stuff. And they like put out a solid like 30% more content than the Labour Party did in the lead up to the election. And this very much fits that model of just like, it doesn't matter what we say or we put out, just as long as it exists.
Yeah.
So, definition of a shit post. Better luck next time, everybody else who did OC in the group this week. We love you anyway. But sorry, nothing made me chuckle
with
the big slap and text of this hilarious face morph video. So, anyway, that's probably enough on that. Now it's time to get into our mains. Oh my god, we've been recording for 45 minutes. Let me ask you a question, listeners. Is it annoying to you that this podcast is now like an hour long regularly? Because we started off, we would shoot for 30 minutes. And if we went over that, we would like cut it down.
Yeah.
We are the only edited podcast on the fucking internet.
So I mostly think people like having a long show. The only person who has even remotely complained about it was my friend Steph, who did a rant for us recently, who listens to it in the car on the way to work, and then if it's too long, has to do a couple blockies, and then if it's like way too long, does a couple blockies,
like, look
and
down
is like,
pocket.
Shit,
hey,
I'm still
oh
only
God.
Halfway through. Yeah. So,
yeah. Well, look, let us know one way or the other.
Please do.
If you,
yeah,
if
yeah.
you like longer and more, I don't know. I don't know if do we. I genuinely don't know if we have more to say. We just read more news now,
yeah.
or we have just become much more long-winded and love the sounds of our own voice because we have a podcast.
Definitely that one a bit. But probably. Yeah.
Anyway, look.
This long bit about doing long bits.
Definitely not, hasn't helped.
Yeah, but we really would appreciate feedback from anyone. If you think it's good or if you think it's bad, let us know what you reckon.
Yeah, yeah. Be interested to know. Cool. All right, so what are we having this week, Noon? I'm hungry and I just want a little snack.
Well, you're going to get a sous vide deal.
Cool pun.
Thanks. Yeah.
What's sous vide?
It's like the internet's most favorite pretentious way of cooking food. You know, a little while ago there was like microchemistry, whatever it was called, you know?
No.
Gel based foods.
Definitely not. Yeah.
Chemical gastronomy. No. Well, anyway, now it's sous vide, which is like cooking in a vacuum, and it distributes the heat perfectly so that you always get your. Whatever broccoli you're steaming, steam evenly or what? I don't know. I don't give a shit.
I'm a it big... just sounds kind of like Green New Deal.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So that's what we're talking about, the Green New Deal. And
which Green
also...
New Deal? There's so many, Noon.
Yeah.
Literally everybody's got one these days.
It's true.
There are so many, like this Climate Justice Collective is working on one.
Modern monetary theorists love the Green New Deal for some reason.
And the Sunrise Movement. Obviously, this is something that came out of the States initially. And the first kind of major proponent of it, I think the person who popularized the concept and or phrase is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
She got it from one of her advisors, I'm pretty sure, who's a big MMT guy. If anyone out there is an MMT person, you're a huge nerd. you might be right, but that doesn't mean you're not a huge nerd. So the reason we're talking about this is that the Greens just got a new leader, which we talked about sort of the politics side of that. But Adam Bandt, who's the new leader, has kind of been coming out swinging, being like, yeah, we're going to do a Green New Deal in Australia, blah, blah, blah. And so we wanted to talk a little bit about what is a Green New Deal and also who is Adam Bandt. So,
yeah, I mean, let's start off with the with a little bit of personal history from Bandt,
sure.
I guess. You did a little bit of reading into this?
Yeah, so I actually was pleasantly surprised to find out that he's way more communist-ier than I thought. I thought he was just kind of like a slightly better Richard Di Natale of like a bland bourgeois nerd who maybe cares about animals and plants.
They are aesthetically very similar.
Yeah, as yeah. Left Renewal likes to point out, they're both balding lawyers, which... definitely doesn't apply to anyone in the Liberal or Labour Party, but thanks.
yeah. I appreciate it.
So Adam Bandt, he was like a hardcore communist and wrote in 95 that the Greens was a party of bourgeoisie and that principled communists shouldn't join it. So, but yeah, he was also like, but maybe they're the best shot that we have of like implementing some reforms. So, you know,
which
yeah.
is kind of what their existence as a party leans
that's
on at
right.
this stage, right?
yeah. So he was an employment lawyer. He got a PhD in law, or whatever it's called, a JD or whatever, that was about how people had misunderstood Marxist jurisprudence and that actually it was different than that. And I can't, like, I'm not lawyery enough or good enough at Marxist theory to really follow what his thesis was about.
Oh, really? My blood is pounding right now. I'm so excited to learn more about Marxist jurisprudence.
Well,
this sounds lit. How is this not a bestseller?
Well, he's actually tried to have it like quashed for the last couple of years so he can publish it as a book. So keep an eye out for this this thrilling bestseller
really
coming soon.
I'm ready, raring to go. My little page turning fingers are red hot.
Anyway, Adam Bandt, pleasant surprise. I think that's enough about him. Whatever. He was a lawyer. He probably helps people. Then he got into parliament.
Yeah, and look, he's been mostly pretty good.
Yeah.
He's obviously the only Greens member of the lower house in the entire country, and it's got to be one of the fucking safest seats in the country.
Like, yes, he is one of the most popular local members probably ever, but definitely at the moment. I think he's number three at the moment with like a 73% margin, which is just insane.
Gotta respect it.
And it's been consistent. So anyway, yeah, he's clearly like got the right demographic voting for him. Yeah.
Melbourne.
Yes. Okay. So the Green New Deal is conceptually based on the New Deal, which was a broad suite of policies that FDR brought in America in the 1930s and 40s, but mostly the 30s. And they, in the US at that time, they were like obviously suffering hugely from the Great Depression. And the Green New Deal was basically a collaboration between the government.
Just the New Deal.
Sorry, just the New Deal, not the Green New Deal. I've just said that phrase and thought it too many times this
morning.
Okay. Yeah. So the New Deal was an agreement between the government, the unions, and big business, and like civil society, I guess you'd call it, of like cultural organizations or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And the main aims of it were to help the economy recover and to help the like poor workers of America like survive the Depression, basically.
Right. So basically to save the country money, they just stopped spending money. Is that because I'm pretty sure that's the best way to save money is to just not spend it. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because a household budget is just the same as the government budget. When you think about it.
Again, this is one of the reasons monetary theorists are super into the Green New Deal is that they're like, money is fake. You can just print more. It's just a way of controlling inflation. Give everyone a job. Yeah.
For anyone who didn't catch my sarcasm, the opposite.
Yeah, okay. So Zach spent a lot of time this week trying to learn about Keynesianism and kept messaging me being like, I don't understand this video. And then I'd send him a different one. He'd be like, this video is too basic. And then I'd send him another one.
How the fuck are you going to blow up my spot on the podcast like this, bro? Talking about how I don't understand YouTube videos and shit. Keynesianism. He just spent money in order to make money.
Yeah, literally.
You gotta spend
it.
Money to make money.
Yeah. That's
I understand
the whole thing.
Keynesianism.
You do.
Yeah. Stagflation.
Yeah.
The Achilles heel of Keynesianism. Sorry. So what did FDR do in order to try and pull America out of depression?
So he increased welfare. He gave people a bunch of jobs. A lot of them were what's called like workfare, so like jobs that weren't producing as much value as they cost to employ people, but then those people would go and spend that money on goods and services, which would then like, you know, stimulate the economy.
And this is the basic principle of Keynesianism. If the government stimulates the economy by spending money on welfare programs and employing people, then that money will go back into the economy and bada bing, bada boom.
And the reason that Australia was one of the countries that survived the global financial crisis most effectively was that we had the Labor Party in government then, and they implemented a bunch of Keynesian measures like giving everyone money to buy a laptop and shit like that.
Fuck yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. And it was extremely effective.
Yeah.
So, as was the New Deal. And it massively increased employment levels. It massively reduced the amount of like household debt and people could afford to go see doctors, that sort of thing. It was really very good until like most of it kind of got repealed in like the Reagan era. And like, as you said, after stagflation, which I think was in 79, whatever, that's a whole boring detail of economic history that isn't really the point here.
Super need to get into. But it's just, like, I guess that just, that's really just for a little bit of, like, historical context for what people, like, where the term Green or New Deal comes from,
yes.
Rather. And obviously, Green New Deal is like that, but with the guiding principle being fighting climate change and environmental action. So when Adam Bandt, was promoted to the leadership of the Greens. He did a press conference and Green New Deal was sort of head of his item list.
Yep.
The main thing he wanted to talk about. And last week when we, or the week before, whenever we mentioned that Adam Bandt was the new leader of the Greens, I kind of made a little bit of a sarcastic comment about the fact that he had listed as the like first and most important items in the Green New Deal, expanding Medicare and specifically including dentistry, dental care and Medicare. And I was a bit like, why isn't the first thing on your Green New Deal list jobs? Because that is really like social programs and employment, specifically like a just transition for people who are working in the energy sector and the fossil fuels industry particularly should be like the keystone of something like this, because the primary political argument against climate action in this country at the moment is an economic one.
Yeah.
And so it makes sense to come out swinging on that. And there are legitimate economic concerns when it comes to like making sure that fossil fuel workers are supported, etc.
Totally.
But so I made some flippant comments about why is jobs not even in the top three of, on this list. But Noon, you kind of disagree with that take.
Well, no, I think you're right in that employment in clean energy jobs or in like mass planting trees or whatever, like there's so many ways that jobs can be involved in this. I really hate jobs rhetoric, and I actually think a jobs guarantee is not an ideal policy platform, though it might be quite effective, like it might get votes on board or whatever. I don't think we should be conceptually framing our response to fucking anything as through jobs. But I do think that there is a lot of political gain there and that probably Adam should do that. And the Greens in general should talk more about jobs for their own advantage, whether or not I think is like good policy.
But you also think that expanding Medicare is a really great cornerstone of a Green New Deal.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, maybe it shouldn't be the number one thing. But like, we were kind of talking about this beforehand, and I think one of the issues with the Green New Deal being the Greens' thing is that it's basically just like all of their policies that they have already were already Green New Deal policies, like deal with climate change and expand Medicare and make sure that we have a strong welfare, like safety net and all this stuff. Like, the Greens have just like written Green New Deal at the top of their already existing policy. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, which is kind of the point I was getting at. They've got this policy platform that sort of is already like socially progressive in relatively speaking by Australian political standards.
And that also involves like government stimulus and spending and guarantees and stuff.
For sure. But it doesn't represent like a new radical policy framework specifically designed to like address this very specific political moment.
Yeah.
It makes me feel a little bit cynical about the framing of it as a Green New Deal. Is it just them adopting a political buzzword that has clearly done the rounds globally speaking?
Yeah.
And seems to be getting people excited. They're just kind of adopting that without actually, without materially providing a framework for a Green New Deal?
Yeah, I think that's right. And look, I think what ideally a Green New Deal would look like is something like a bunch of new federal agencies set up to allocate the difficult tasks of transitioning to a zero carbon economy to specific companies and people, right? So we got a bit of this under the Gillard, Bob Brown, like climate package that, you know, there was the ARENA and the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, all of these other things that then would like put money into stuff or would hire people or the renewable energy target, like that those bureaucracies would then sort of trickle downwards. So the reason that I think a jobs guarantee might be sort of intertwined with this would be, it would be like, I'm unemployed, I'm on a job, I'll go onto this website and there's a job installing housing insulation, and so I can get that job. And so that like we connect the unemployed and like the economic stuff that we need to the like practical tasks that we need to decarbonize our economy. And like, I think
makes sense to me.
Makes perfect sense.
Do you, like, off the top of your head, I'm really not super familiar with the Greens policy platform. I'm going to admit that off top, you know, I've got a pretty superficial analysis here. Would you say that that kind of thing is inherent in Greens policy at the moment? Or have you seen anything in their Green New Deal talk about something like that?
Not that I've seen, but I don't think it's in any way contrary. Like, I think the Greens could easily decide to implement their policy by doing something like this.
Yeah.
And presumably the more they use the rhetoric of the Green New Deal, the more likely they're going to come up with specific policy proposals like this. But as we know, like, the Greens aren't ever basically in a position to legislate at all. So the details of their policies aren't really that important in that sense.
Not as important as it would be for Labor or Liberal.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. And also I think I have slightly more faith in the Greens to actually figure out sensible ways to implement their policies if they're ever in a situation where that might happen, as with when they were negotiating with Gillard. But I think, yeah, the whole concept of the Green New Deal makes so much more sense in the United States, and there's a few reasons for that. One is that I think they kind of have a lot further to go. So you're we're talking about dental being included in Medicare, while the current Democrat presidential primaries is all about, should we have Medicare for all, right? Like, they are literally like a century behind us. Mm. I don't know, a century. They're like way behind us in this kind of stuff. And what looks to us like really simple, basic, like, functions of the state, like providing cheap medical care, is like a huge revolutionary thing for them. So that's kind of why I thought it made sense that the dental plan being included in Medicare makes sense as part of the Green New Deal, because like actually providing free and accessible healthcare is a really important basis of the like social democratic welfare Keynesianism or whatever. Yeah. Though again, I don't necessarily think it should be like the top of their list. Mm. One of the reasons that I'm not super excited about the Green New Deal in Australia isn't about anything of the policy. It's about the optics. And we often try not to focus too much on that sort of stuff in this show and try to look at like actually how is stuff affecting people in the real world. But there's a connection between the optics and the outcomes. And so I think it's folly for the Greens to start trying to talk about a Green New Deal, because I think there is a 0% chance that Labor or Liberal will ever adopt any policy that has the word green in it. And I know that seems like a silly or kind of facile point. And like, obviously, and Labor and Liberals aren't interested in
because they are silly regardless. And facile.
Yeah, but that's it. They're silly and facile people. And if they adopt something, you can't imagine Albanese going around being like, we need a Green New Deal. We need green anything, right? He doesn't even, like, they don't talk about green energy.
I mean, he's struggling to say that we shouldn't build new coal-fired power stations.
Sure, I mean, there's a lot of reasons you can't imagine why he wouldn't say that. But, like, the very phrase Green New Deal is good advertising for the Greens, and therefore it's never going to be picked up by the broader society. Mm. So,
is that what they're shooting for?
I don't know what the Greens' tactics are, honestly, if they're trying to win a minority balance of power, if they want to get a majority, or if they're a party of protest. I don't think they really know.
They're not an especially internally consistent party.
No.
Which, you know, obviously has its drawbacks, but I'd like to point out that that is in some ways a good thing as well.
Sure.
Internal consistency is one of the things that has completely paralyzed the Labor Party.
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously it's a swings and roundabouts type situation that we've got here.
Yeah. I think that's sort of all of my hot takes. It's like a little intro to what a Green New Deal might look like, what it's for, what the history is, and why maybe it's not necessarily the best angle to be shooting for in Australian politics at the moment.
Mm.
I don't necessarily have a different proposal, like, should we have a clean New Deal or a new climate deal? Or like, I think New Deal is conceptually sound because people who are aware of the history of it understand what that means, and I think a forward-looking version of that is possibly like might be useful in uniting the broad left and like opposing the rise of fascism across the globe, having this like kind of flashy policy suite that's actually going to really help with the economic pain that a lot of, you know, young white men are feeling and that sort of thing. I think that the policies involved are really good. I just think maybe the advocates of the Green New Deal should think about some different branding in Australia, at least.
Sure. That's your take.
Yeah.
Take it or leave it.
It's lukewarm. It's not a hot take.
It's not especially hot. And look,
it's been in their sous vide for like half an hour, but
I mean, it's definitely the same consistency all the way through.
Yeah.
Which is mild. cool. That'll probably do us finally for this week. I get fucking exhausted by the end of 1 hour of
talking
politics. If you're still with us, good job.
Thanks.
And thank you. If you're enjoying the show, please share us. Tell a friend.
Yeah, that would be really good.
Please tell a friend. Share us on your Facebook or your Twitter or even your Instagram. We should probably get on Instagram.
Yeah.
if you really like what we do, please head over to our Patreon, where you can become a monthly donor for as little as $1 a month. That gives you one bonus episode every month. We're recording our bonus episode today. So if you're already a patron, we'll see you later in the week for the bonus episode. Higher tiers get more rewards. Also, you can follow us on Facebook at OzPolSnackPod. You can follow us on Twitter at OzPolSnackPod. As we always say, please come and join the Ozpol Shitposting Facebook group if you want to be part of the conversation. I think that's probably about it.
Yeah.
Keep on snacking in the free world.
Crunch, crunch.